Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Brent Plater. He's the executive director of the Wild Equity Institute, a San Francisco-based nonprofit organization that unites social justice and grassroots conservation movements in campaigns that build a more sustainable and just world for all. He's also a lecturer at San Francisco State University's Environmental Studies Program and an adjunct professor at Golden State University School of Law. So thank you for your work and thank you for being on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So tell me about the Wild Equity Institute.
Well, you know, the Wild Equity Institute was started as an experiment, sort of as a startup, about 5 years ago now, after I made the realization that despite all the work that I'd done in my own career, I'd been a pro enviro for about 15 years or so at the time, great successes we had in litigating for various endangered species and communities that have been underserved or impacted adversely by environmental justice issues. Despite all these great victories we had at the largest scale, the number of species on the brink, the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, the amount of inequity across our human communities, those things had all gotten worse. And that was true not just across my own career, but also the career of all my contemporaries and all the enviros who came before us. At some level, our movement was failing. And I wanted to see if there was a way that we could try and tweak our work a little bit that would give us a better opportunity to be successful, not just on these individual campaigns, but ultimately on the larger scale problems that we struggle with. And the theory that we came up with is that there was an opportunity to bring some different movements together that don't always work collaboratively through a shared moral foundation. The way we describe what the shared moral foundation is between, say, grassroots conservation groups, social justice groups, environmental justice groups, is through this concept of equity, that in each case, each of these movements, including conservation movements, are ultimately trying to make a more fair, a more just relationship between us and another community or towards the land or another species, and that the movements were all linked, all these different movements were linked, and that they would see how we actually behave, they'd compare that to how we ought to act, how they knew in their hearts and their minds we ought to act, and they'd see a gap between those two poles, and they just attacked that gap. And in that sense, all of our movements were linked in trying to make a more equitable world than they found. And so our thought was, if that's true, if there's any resonance to that, if we can demonstrate that we have some shared ethical or moral foundation, then perhaps we can bring these movements together, work collaboratively in campaigns where we have a shared interest, and build the movement up to scale so that we have enough resources to bear against these extraordinarily large problems. Because at the end of the day, it seems like that's one of the key problems in addressing those larger trends, is the scale of the problem is far larger than the scale of the resources we bring to bear against it. So just to demonstrate what that means in practice, just I can give you a couple of examples of some campaigns we work on here in the San Francisco Bay Area. One, for example, it turns out that the city and county of San Francisco owns a golf course in another city called Pacifica, about 15 miles south of San Francisco. And the golf course loses money hand over fist. They have to send general fund taxpayer dollars to subsidize this golf course every year to the tune of somewhere between $100,000 and $300,000 a year, while at the same time, they've been slashing services for neighborhood parks and community services year after year after year. And that seemed like a social injustice. It didn't seem fair that they'd be spending money on a suburban golf course in San Mateo County while slashing neighborhood park programs and community services in San Francisco. On top of that, the golf course is in one of the last viable habitats for two critically imperiled species: the California red-legged frog, which is sometimes called Twain's frog because it's the central character in Mark Twain's short story, The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. And the other species, which really breaks my heart, is called the San Francisco garter snake. Scientists say it's both the most imperiled and most beautiful serpent in all of North America. So you can't argue either one of those points. Scientists have said it. And it kills both, the golf course kills both species every year. And so we came up with a plan to work with some groups from across the political spectrum in San Francisco to repurpose Sharp Park as a new kind of public park everybody can enjoy, including the frog and the snake, and then take the money that San Francisco saves by allowing the National Park Service to manage that property. The city can then take that money they save and reinvest it in whatever we desire: neighborhood parks, community services, make a more just world in our civil communities. So that's just one example of the kind of things we're attempting to do.
But I'm sorry, Brent, but that can never actually work because it makes too much sense.
Well, I think in some ways we have,
I'm kidding, of course.
I know, but you make a fair point though. We have a lot of compelling arguments about why that particular campaign should occur and should be successful. And so sometimes the challenge is if you have too many arguments, nobody remembers any of them, right? It's almost sometimes it's better to have a simplistic argument that just says, here's one good reason why, or a couple of good reasons why you should agree with us and leave the rest aside. So we have struggled a little bit in trying to tailor our message so to increase the amount of sort of impact it has.
So I do want to hear the next example, but I want to come back to this one for a second because it's such a clear and compelling example, I think. What are some of the counter arguments that you make? Because I can't see if they're A, losing money, B, harming endangered species. This is not in order of importance, but cutting other services elsewhere. I mean, the only argument seems to be made is that this is good for a few golfers who get subsidized golfing. I mean, are there any other arguments against what you're saying?
That is the key point, and plus, of course, Derek, the existing golf course occupies the status quo, which of course gives it an additional amount of power and an additional amount of inertia that we have to overcome to be successful. Of course, anytime you're trying to stop something from happening, you have a strategic advantage of when you're trying to change the world to make it a little bit better. And so that of course makes it difficult as well. But you're right, the primary argument against it is that it currently is providing subsidized golfing rates for, a couple hundred golfers who use the course regularly, and that's the main opposition. Now, what their proposal has, I think everybody agrees generally that the status quo at this golf course cannot be maintained. It loses too much money, causes too many environmental problems. The question is, what will the land become? We put forward this proposal that we believe makes a lot more sense and creates a more beautiful, more just world in the long run, while solving some financial and environmental problems in the short run. What some of the golfers have proposed instead is to redevelop the golf course into a more expensive, more elite quality golf course, try to convince a private golf developer to invest in that vision by giving it a long-term lease, 99-year lifetime lease, so that they'll be willing to invest their own capital money into building that new kind of expensive, more elite golf course, and then see if it makes any money. And if it does, they'd have to give the city some cut, some fraction of the revenue that comes in the door. And for a handful of the more business-oriented politicians in San Francisco's political spectrum, that is a very compelling argument to them. Our argument gets them to zero, which is better than where they are right now. But this alternative argument gets them to zero plus some small possibility of some small additional amount of money. And so for those folks who are really motivated by that profit motive or the idea that they need to generate revenue off these public assets, they want to try and give the golf course one sort of 30-year chance, one more 30-year capital project, as it were. They often measure the success or the lifespan of these public capital projects in 30-year increments. Give the golf course one more 30-year increment, and then if it doesn't work out, then they'll create a different kind of vision out there. That's their argument. Now, the problem with that for us is multiple, but the most critical one is that the San Francisco garter snake, which is the most imperiled vertebrate on the San Francisco Peninsula, very likely to be the next vertebrate that we will lose if something isn't done about it soon. If that vision comes to reality, we will almost certainly lose the garter snake. It will not be around anymore. And we just can't afford to have that happen.
So what's this is that's all really interesting and important stuff. What's the next example you're going to give?
The other campaign that we have active right now is involves some power plants here in the Bay Area. So about several years ago, I was a full-time professor at Golden Gate University's law school, where I'm now an adjunct, and they have an environmental law and justice clinic where I taught. And the clinic, when I got there, this campaign was just on its tail end, but the clinic and many other grassroots environmental justice organizations in the city worked for a long time to close two power plants in San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood, which has traditionally been a minority neighborhood in the city, and on environmental justice grounds. Now, once those two power plants went offline, the California Public Utilities Commission, the California Energy Commission wanted to recoup the lost power when those two power plants were closed. And more or less what they did is they looked to find the next most vulnerable community that was not as well organized as the communities in the city, where they could dump a whole slew of new power plants. And the communities they settled on are two communities in the eastern part of Contra Costa County along the Bay Delta, the communities of Antioch and Oakley, California. And over the course of a few years, they approved five different power plants to operate within about roughly a mile, maybe a 2 mile radius of each other. But they approved them all separately to try and avoid some of the environmental constraints that would apply if they considered it as one huge mega project. And this is going to pollute cumulatively. It'll pollute much more into communities that are largely minority, largely blue-collar communities, which is just another environmental justice issue. But on top of that, it turns out that these power plants are adjacent to a very interesting wildlife refuge that's found in Antioch called the Antioch Dunes National Wildlife Refuge. And this wildlife refuge is the last home to probably the second most imperiled butterfly in the United States. It's called the Lang's Metalmark Butterfly. And the pollution that will come out of these natural gas-fired power plants, the pollution that irritates the lungs of the local community, also poisons the soil. It can deposit into the soil, changing the chemical composition of the soil, and it makes it unfavorable for the host plant of the butterfly to thrive. And without the host plant, the butterfly just can't persist. So the Fish and Wildlife Service, in this case, actually took a very strong stance against these power proposals, demanded that the EPA and the California Energy Commission try and prevent this huge amount of impact on the local wildlife refuge, and they just got blanked. The California Energy Commission and the Public Utilities Commission just refused to do any kind of significant mitigation for either the communities out there that were being impacted or the butterfly. So we brought a campaign together with some environmental justice groups and some lepidopterists and butterfly lovers, brought them together and brought a claim against one of the power plant owner and operators, one called Oakley, the Oakley facility out there in Oakley, California. And we brought this lawsuit against them, and they actually settled with us. They settled with us, and they created this very large mitigation fund to preserve the local community's health. They agreed to spend millions of dollars on community health as well as restoration efforts at the dunes, or if they refuse to put that money up, they can't build the facility at all. So we were able to sort of leverage some additional protection that these different disparate communities weren't able to do on their own by bringing them together and creating a different kind of amount of force to make the world hopefully a little bit better than it was when we found it.
And how much, when you bring together the social justice groups and the environmental groups, do the groups basically ally in these particular cases because they simply have they see how the alliance can be useful, or do they actually oftentimes strongly empathize and I don't know what the word is, because they actually see the do these end up being alliances of convenience alone, or these end up being actual more long-term alliances that are developing? Do you see what I'm asking?
I do. It's a great question. You know, I grew up in the Midwest.
Which I don't have a problem, by the way, with alliances of convenience.
Of course. You know, I hear what you're saying. You know, I grew up in the Midwest, where there's still a much more vibrant sort of right wing to fight against. And so there tends to be a lot less sort of infighting between progressive, you know, left communities out there than I observed when I moved to the Bay Area, where there's really no right wing out here anymore. And so you have it's a lot easier for these different strains of progressive thought to kind of move to their logical conclusions. And then if you take any movement to its logical conclusion, you can start stepping on the toes of other groups. And there's definitely some of that history here in the Bay Area and some tension across various movements, whether it's labor and immigration or immigration and environment, et cetera, et cetera. So that's definitely something that's challenging. And I'd say, you know, that it's a mix. I think maybe 15 years ago or even 10 years ago, it would have been more difficult for that empathy to be observed. But I think one of the things that has happened as the evidence about climate change has mounted, not only in terms of how rapidly we're changing the atmosphere, but also with the evidence that the people who are most likely to be adversely impacted are going to be the poor, the impoverished, the disenfranchised. As that's been observed, there's been some opportunity for these different movements to sort of see the link between and across their movements that I think was a little bit harder to observe before that realization started to come across both the environmental movement and social justice movement. So I think it's a little bit easier now than it used to be. That said, I think in practice, it's a mix. Some people get it. Some people get the connection we're trying to make. Others, it may be just a matter of convenience. Our hope is, and my experience generally has been, that if we do a good job bringing groups together and we're successful, you know, once when campaigns work well, when they're successful, people tend to like each other. They want to get to know each other. They want to work together again in the future. They start to build empathy for each other. And hopefully, just in some small incremental way, they start to incorporate the sort of fundamental ethical basis as well. You know, it's not something that I think we make a precondition to our movement, but it's something that I think if we're right, I mean, it's always possible we're wrong, but if we're right and there's something there that can be useful for our movements, that as we can build those alliances and some successes together, that it will come.
Well, and it seems like with the two examples that you gave me so far, it seems like you've chosen your campaigns very well. And it seems to me that no one, except for somebody who wants to hand money to developers plus some golfers, can really oppose your Sharp Park plan. I mean, that just seems like such a – I don't mean this as an insult to you. I mean, it actually is a great thing to you, but it seems like such a no-brainer, you know? It seems like you've chosen an absolutely brilliant campaign there to try to tie them together, as opposed to somewhere else that might – I mean, like it was always difficult fighting against a lot of the old-growth logging or against the logging on national forests, because it was always pitted as jobs versus owls or whatever.
Sure.
And it's much easier, it seems to me. It's much more tactically, much more strategic to pit it as everybody versus golfers.
I think that's so.
And I'm sorry if I'm using the word versus inappropriately here.
Well, you know, I do feel, you know, I've just as an aside, you know, I've been an athlete for most of my life, you know, I played college sports and that sort of thing. So, and I used to be a caddy. So, you know, I know the game of golf pretty well. I haven't played in a long, long time for a variety of reasons. And, you know, I'm not opposed to golf per se. And I actually think in the long run, our campaign will benefit golfers far more than having some new, more expensive golf course being built out there that would be less accessible to the average person. Having said all that, I agree. In some ways, you know, it makes a lot of sense to try and find things that don't necessarily come up against, you know, vested, powerful economic interests. On the other hand, you know, the golfers are a little bit more, you know, relatable to the average person than, say, you know, Palco or, you know, Maxam or something like that, you know, where you have something on the other side, which, you know, might be a little bit more palatable to people who aren't, you know, aware of the actual evidence. And so that can be challenging. But I do have to say, I generally agree with you, Derek, that this is a no-brainer. And yet the campaign has had a lot of success, but it hasn't been won yet. Right. So we still need to close that deal out. And you know, in hindsight, as we learn how to navigate under this relatively new umbrella – you know, we'll hopefully learn from some of the mistakes we've made in the past and make some of these no-brainer challenges come to fruition more rapidly so that, you know, we can move on into building this larger movement that we hope to eventually see.
Well, that's actually my next question is, both of those are local or Bay Area regional. Are you looking to replicate this elsewhere, or are you looking to expand yourself? Are you looking to stay local to the Bay Area? What are you looking at for the future, for the, and not in terms of campaigns, but in terms of the largest, and not in terms of the largest, you know, what do you want to do about industrial civilization, but in terms of sort of the middle scale, what do you want to do with your organization?
Well, two things. One, you know, the main reason we have Bay Area campaigns on our agenda at the moment and not other kinds of campaigns is because we're here and we're still pretty small. You know, we're still a pretty small grassroots organization. And so we have certain resource limitations. I only have so much time in my day, et cetera. But that's the only reason, you know, as if we become larger and more successful, we'd certainly love to help campaigns that have similar kinds of tie-ins in other parts of the country and in the world where we have some advice or something valuable to help with. But the other thing I hope for, and I think really the more powerful thing is, well, I hope will be more powerful is, you know, the idea, the strategy itself is something that doesn't require Wild Equity or me or any of our other colleagues or staff to implement it. If the idea has some resonance and it can give other people who are working on making a more beautiful, more just world some inspiration to think about how they do their work on a day-to-day basis or consider how to build stronger alliances with groups that maybe they've just sort of circled around each other for years, you know, I think that would be the greatest of all possible worlds. If it somehow helps inspire people to do their own work in a more effective way or a more successful way, that's really the goal.
Okay, so let's just say that I live in Chicago or rural Eastern Kentucky or rural New Mexico. It doesn't matter. I live somewhere not near you, and I see equivalence in my community to what you're talking about. Let's just say it's the exact same example of a power plant that's going in that is both harming humans and harming native species. And I mean, what is it that you want me to do, and what is the general notion that you're actually propagating to me, and what do you want me to do?
Fair enough.
I really like what I'm hearing, what do you want me to do about it in this other place?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. You know, sometimes single issue campaigns can be successful on their own. So sometimes that'll be enough to at least win that one battle over that one power plant. But I think what's lacking in those instances is the opportunity to not only be successful on the small scale, but build this larger to scale movement that will not only win that one power plant, but would potentially, you know, resolve the climate crisis altogether. And so what I would urge people to do is to think not only what it would be expedient to do in the moment to win the campaign, right? So sometimes they just, well, what if I bring this one tailored lawsuit on this narrow issue that could, you know, derail the entire regulatory process, which, you know, may have success, may actually be successful in that one instance, but is going to fail to build a large movement. To also think about how they can build some alliances through some commonality, maybe this theory about equity that we have will be that commonality. Build it with some other organizations and try and, you know, bring those interests together so they can see each other, understand their bases for existence, and how they can advance each other's movements in the long run more successfully than if they're in their little silos. And so for example, you know, sometimes that might be a labor who might be able to help. Sometimes that might be health organizations that are looking for some way to deal with public health crises in the community. Sometimes that might be, you know, other recreational user groups. Sometimes it might be people who provide community services and they're having their budgets slashed as more and more of our budgets go to things that tend to be the opposite of building safe, healthy communities. Find those entities and try and bring them into a coalition that can be bigger than just the success or failure of that one campaign.
You know, this reminds me of two things. One of them is that I've said for the longest time, that I've used this example, it's a real example, that when I would go into the local computer store, the locally owned computer store, I would not talk to the person behind the counter about who owned the place about how this culture is killing salmon, because he didn't really care about that very much. What I would talk about is how Walmart is destroying local businesses, because he was actually being driven out of business by Walmart. So I would find the place where he was really interested and then try to talk about that and talk about the larger issues like corporate control, not in terms to him about how it was harming the salmon, but in terms of him about how it was destroying local businesses. And so he would find where he was interested in the struggle. By the way, he did get driven out of business and now he has to work at the prison, which is just, you know, everything we're talking about in some ways.
That's right.
So is that part of it too? Just finding the places, you know, I'm sure that there are people in, what was the community? Oakley, was that it?
That's right. Oakley and Antioch, the two cities.
Yeah. I'm sure that there are, like you said, are some people who, frankly, there are some people who love butterflies and are very upset that humans are also having trouble breathing. And there are some people who love butterflies who don't really care about the people, and there are some people who are upset because people are having trouble breathing, but they don't really care about butterflies. And once again, I don't see why they can't work together on this one particular issue. It just seems to make so much sense to me. And yes, it's great when you can then, and maybe I'm just restating the same thing that you're saying, and then once you get them all together, you help them see that they have this, that even if they don't particularly care about butterflies or humans breathing, that they still have that. There still are those, what do we want to say, levers? Or what are the points? Axles, is that what I'm looking for?
Yeah, or just some fundamental principle of what's fair or just, you know, that we all – that is triggered by these different issues, right? I think to some degree, and correct me if I'm wrong interpreting some of your work, or even deep green resistance generally is – It's almost like there's some singularity which underlies a lot of the things that we feel to be unjust or wrong in the world, and that singularity is the thing, is the reason why you can link, you know, militarism and sexism and environmental problems, that there's some root cause perhaps of all of these different injustices. Things emanate from there. And you know, maybe somebody who's, you know, really been working on, you know, eliminating sexism hasn't thought very much about why the salmon are going extinct, or you know, small business owners getting run out by these mega corporations, and hasn't thought very much about, you know, equal pay for equal work. But if you can figure out how to demonstrate that all of these problems emanate from some root condition, once that realization is made, I think it becomes easier to start having that conversation about how they can participate in ridding our world of all of these different kinds of injustices.
And one of the things I love about your work is that it bridges the gap between that theory and the actual work on the ground, because that's the thing, is that I've written 20-some books, but the truth is those have not accomplished anything in the real physical world by themselves, because a book can't. It's just theory. It can inform practice. And then at the same time, you've got all these activists who are doing this great work. But honestly, a lot of the frontline activists I know don't have the time to stop and read a lot of theory, because basically they're reading a bunch of environmental impact statements.
That is challenging.
And so that's one of the things I'm loving about your work is that you seem to be manifesting that combination of, oh God, I'm going to use some jargon here, that combination of theory and praxis that I think is so important.
Well, yeah, you know, I think it started from this realization, you know, what sort of shook me to bother to think a little bit more deeply about how and why I went about my day-to-day activism was this realization that, you know, at the larger scale, we were failing. And to this day, that's still true. You know, I Wild Equity is about 5 years old now. I mean, there was about a year there where I was away for I was a Fulbright scholar for a year. And so that was, you know, wasn't doing a lot of work on Wild Equity at that time, but you know, I can't prove, you know, I don't have enough evidence to suggest that this theory we have is going to work. I don't know that for sure. What I know for sure is that the other things that I've tried and the other things I've observed other people try to date have resulted in this situation where we can win a few campaigns here and there on the ground and still lose the war overall. And I wanted to at least try to see if I could come up with an idea that could at least in theory, you know, reverse that trend. And I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure if it'll work. You know, I think it's, and I, you know, I'm some days I'm very hopeful that it'll work. Some days I wish that someone else will come along with an even better theory and solve all these problems for us so we can all go home and retire. But we are trying, and I think, you know, we do have with our campaigns at least a seed of feasibility of this being helpful, and so we're going to keep working at it.
So without divulging anything that is supposed to be secret, do you have any campaigns you're considering bringing on in the near future?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of places where I see, you know, some commonality, you know, and the main, again, usually the main reason why we don't just bring them right away is just figuring out how to maintain our existing workload while adding on something new. That's always a challenge. But there's some great opportunities. You know, a lot of the things that we do as environmentalists is just stopping something bad from happening, which is essential, but not enough to reverse the trends that we see in the world around us. And so one of the things we've been trying to do is start thinking more about how we can deliver, you know, speaking like with some jargon myself, but how can we deliver an environmental good to communities that have been underserved by things like parks and open space, for example, rather than just trying to stop the next crappy thing that nobody wants in their community from being dumped in their backyard, which is, of course, something we also work on. But can we reverse that trend and actually start, you know, delivering positive things in their communities that can develop a better, stronger connection, not only to each other, to the people in those communities, but also towards the land, to the other plants and animals that have historically been their biological neighbors, that raise those kinds of connections. So those are that's another kind of work that we're developing and hoping to get more active in the near future.
And once again, if you don't reveal anything you don't want to reveal, but are there any specific ones of those? Like, what do you mean by bringing environmental goods? What would be an example of that that either you're considering or that has been done?
So here's an example. This is another one here in the Bay Area. But there we have a national park in the Bay Area called the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. And when you look at the legislative history about why this park was created, it was created during this era of park creation, which is referred to as the Parks to the People movement, where the National Park Service looked around at the people traveling to faraway national parks like Yellowstone and the Grand Canyon, and they realized that the vast majority of visitors were wealthy and white. And so they weren't able to deliver this unique management mandate that the National Park Service has, this non-impairment mandate, they call it, which is this sort of singular idea that's very distinct from other types of land management at the Bureau of Land Management or the Forest Service, for example. Not that it's without any problem. There's certainly problems with the Park Service, but in general, it's a more holistic, better view of the way we should relate to the landscape and the Park Service. But they wanted to deliver that idea to people who couldn't afford, either with time because they didn't have enough time or because they didn't have enough money, to travel to these faraway parks. And so they built this national park right in the urban center of the Bay Area, at the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. But to this day, they still struggle with getting the diversity of people of the Bay Area to actually utilize the Golden Gate National Recreation Area's resources. And so there's struggles with programming, there's struggles with just the demographics of the areas that are closest to the park, the ones that are just, you know, right out the back door are different from the ones that are across town. And so we started this program that was going to work, try to work on that. It was called it's called Wild Quest. We have one for school age kids as well called Endangered Semester. And essentially what we do is we create this competition for people to get out into the local park, observe it, and see the endangered species that are found in our local national park. It turns out that GGNRA has more endangered species in it than any other national park in continental North America. So get them out to see these plants and animals, experience the National Park Service in a particular way, recognize its distinctions from other kinds of municipal recreation areas that have a different mandate, often a much more development-oriented mandate, and then try to take some action that will help those species recover while connecting them to things that are critical in their own communities. So, for example, sometimes we'll have action items that are about building skill sets for organizing in their community or making healthier lifestyle choices that also benefit endangered species, and try to build that connectivity, tell a story that says, look, the things that are creating the injustices you feel in your home are similar to the things that the injustice of the snowy plover feels as it's being pushed towards extinction, or something like that. Try to develop that connection a little bit while developing this opportunity to take advantage of this incredible resource that was, you know, at least in the legislative history, was built for them. And yet the National Park Service still struggles to deliver that environmental benefit to some of these communities. So that's an example. I hope that kind of makes sense as another kind of way to think about our work. That's not quite the same as the litigation or the lobbying type work in the Antioch Dunes and the Shark Park campaign, but still tries to deliver that message that the conservation and the justice issues that we see around us are linked in some way.
You know, that's one of the things I was thinking when you were talking about people in cities, not the people to the parks idea, is I remember this from 20 years ago. I had this friend who used to take children, this is in Spokane, Washington, who used to take children from schools to parks. And it broke my heart one day when she talked about these students from Spokane, which is not a very big city, being at the park, and they were running away terrified of butterflies because they thought they were going to get stung. And these children had not actually seen butterflies before. And that broke my heart.
Yeah, there's still a lot of that, even in a lot of communities where there's just not the opportunity to understand their biological natives. And you also have to keep in mind, some of these communities, I don't know much about Spokane, but some parts of San Francisco this day, Oakland, East Bay, Antioch for sure, they're communities where people are under constant threat. There's a lot of issues that they deal with that affect their health, their well-being, et cetera. And so, they may develop, certain mechanisms to deal with things that are unfamiliar that maybe you have to sort of work through a little bit.
I wasn't blaming the kid at all. I was just saying the fact that the children were like fourth and fifth grade, and the fact that they simply had not seen a butterfly.
No, fair enough. I didn't mean to imply that, but thank you for that correction. But I hear what you're saying. It is heartbreaking. We still see that fair amount too. And the other thing we see is like they might have like a conceptual idea of what, a wild bird is, or a marine mammal, or something like that, but they don't know it well enough to say this bird is somehow uniquely at risk compared to this other bird, right? There's sort of to recognize that this particular plant is something that's endemic and rare and about to get blown out of this local community in the same way it feels like African Americans are being lost from San Francisco these days. There's some new stats out here saying that San Francisco is going to become the whitest city in California in a few years if current trends continue. Because they don't, there's almost like there isn't enough differentiation between what they understand conceptually of as a bird and like each individual species of bird that may have its own kind of unique needs and threats. And so I think as we develop stories around how these particular species face some common type of, at least at the, at sort of the conceptual level, some common type of threat that they might be dealing with in some similar kind of way in their own community. They don't have a voice in the halls of power, right? That's a common issue with a lot of local communities. The wealthier communities have much greater access to the levers of power. Well, that's also true for the snowy plover. And it has no direct representation by design. How could it? Right? So you're trying to build some stories that can tie those threats together, and they start to develop the kinds of openness to and interest in studying butterflies, for example, or birds, and realizing that they're potential allies and not threats.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and I have still like three questions, so we're going to have to really move on these quickly. Sorry about that. The first question is, can you talk briefly, obviously, about the miracle manzanita? I find that story so moving.
Yeah, so there was this particular kind of manzanita called the Franciscan manzanita that was presumed extinct in the wild for decades. And then one day during a construction process in the Presidio, some vegetation was being cleared, and a friend of mine happened to be driving down the road, and he observed a manzanita out of the corner of his eye. He's a very good botanist. He's now the president of the California Native Plant Society, a guy named Daniel Glusenkamp. And he knew enough that if you see a manzanita in San Francisco without being able to identify the species, you've got something miraculous. And so a bunch of phone calls were made, and they were able to identify this as the lost manzanita. But the problem was the manzanita had been presumed extinct in the wild for a number of years, so it had never been formally given any legal protection under the Endangered Species Act, for example, because the Endangered Species Act protects endangered species, not extinct ones. And so Caltrans could have bulldozed it on the spot without any legal consequence. So Wild Equity filed an emergency petition to protect that plant, and eventually a deal was worked out to move that individual plant to another location in the park, because once all that vegetation was cleared, they didn't think it was going to be a suitable habitat anymore. The soil was going to get too dried out, et cetera. About another spot, and now they're working on recovering the entire species from this one plant. And that's possible because although it was extinct in the wild, unique genetic individuals were preserved in botanical gardens around the Bay Area just for this kind of opportunity for decades. And so they have great genetics on these manzanitas, and so our work eventually got critical habitats protected for recovery efforts in the city, and that was the first time ever that any land of the city and county of San Francisco had ever been designated as critical habitat. And it just happened a couple of years ago, so that was very heartwarming to have that success, to be part of that success.
Yeah, that makes me really happy. So I was going to ask you about something that you and I talked about on the phone a month or two ago about some of the opposition to your work has come from. Where has some of that come from? But I don't think we have time right now. I think to sort of close off, I would like to just ask, what if you could have people all over the country, anybody who's listening to this is going to care about the natural world and care about social justice. So if they already have both of those impulses, and they live in Louisville, Kentucky, or Louisville, Colorado, what do you want them to do?
Well, first of all, I'd love to hear from folks. If they have similar kinds of ideas or working on similar projects, they can reach us at our website at wildequity.org, and we'd love to hear about the stuff they're working on as well. But I think my main message would be keep innovating, right? Try to find the place in your heart where it speaks to you that you become interested in these things that sometimes are seen as separate movements and there are separate silos. Find that place in your heart and start building both building campaigns, building your work, not only for the thing from the things that you know, the science, the evidence that you're able to collect, but also the things you feel in your heart, and bring those things to the forefront as well. Because I feel like the environmental movement, to some degree, social justice movements, we're very good at building campaigns around facts. And we get away too often from the things we believe in our hearts, which you know is often the place where people fundamentally make the decisions about the things they're gonna care about and build into their lives for change. And so start trying to bring those things together in ways that build this more just world we're all working for.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Brent Plater. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.